And welcome back to Coast with Timothy Green Beckley with his latest work, UFO Hostilities and the Evil Alien Agenda. Let's continue chatting with him about that and also take your calls on Coast to Coast. And welcome back, Timothy Green Beckley with us. Tim, can you tell us a little bit about that incredible story of the Battle of Los Angeles where we were shooting at an object that thousands of people saw in the skies over L.A.? What the heck was going on?
Well, the date on that event was February 25th, 1942. And the next day, the L.A. Times had a huge headline across the front page that says, "Mystery Air Object Seen in Sky Over L.A." Now, on the night in question, over 1,500 shots were fired from large artillery cannons. And an object or objects that are hovered over Culver City. I mean, that's where most of the action seemed to have taken place. Several people were injured, and several even died from the result of the bombardment and from heart attacks. Okay, now, the object was seen. It was hovered just above the cloud covering, so most people did not get a good view of the craft itself, but it was huge, several hundred feet in diameter, and there are both stills and footage, newsreel footage of the beams of light striking the object, and we shot all these shells at it, and then eventually it just kind of slowly drifted away. Now, one witness who did get a apparently a unobstructed view of the object said it reminded him of a silvery lozenger-shaped bug, all right? And it gave off an orange glow that came from the interior of the object. And apparently now filmmaker Jose Escamilla, who you've had on the, on the program, and we both know him, of course, he's a pretty credible filmmaker. He just doesn't make this stuff up. He says that he's found a couple of witnesses that are have still memory of the event that took place, and that apparently at least one of the objects was shot down and crashed into the ocean. Hmm. Now, the government, you know, the next day and for following weeks after that, said it was just war jitters, that there was no real unidentified object in the sky. But I don't even think in those days, why would the military shoot 1,500 shells at this object or objects and endanger the lives of, individuals on the ground?
And people could hear, Tim, couldn't they hear pinging every time something hit?
No. No, apparently... they were never, it was this, the object was cloaked in some sort of force field or something that, now, this has happened, in fact, in a lot of cases where these objects have been shot at. I only know of one case where the bullet actually hit the object and made a sound. I believe that was in Bangor, Maine. But most of the cases where these things have been shot at, they don't seem to make any sound whatsoever. But anyway, this stayed in the consciousness of people who lived out there in L.A. for many, many years, and people still talk about it to this day, you know. And it seems, of course, this was at the end of the war. It seems that there is a increase in this UFO activity, especially the hostile aspects of it, whenever there is a battle or a global conflict going on. I mean, we mentioned the Foo Fighters during the First and Second World War, but you know, Mussolini even took an interest, believe it or not, in the subject. Apparently, from what we're led to believe, there was a UFO crash in 1936 outside of Milan, somewhere, and Mussolini heard about it, and There were other sightings of a cigar-shaped object, and there are even the documents, somewhat similar to the MJ-12 documents here, of drawings of what the craft looked like. It was cigar-shaped and so forth. And directive from the dictator to the military about what to do if these objects appeared again. In fact, you know, Churchill wanted to know what the heck all this flying saucer craziness was about. And, of course, Ronald Reagan often made a statement several times in front of the UN once that he felt that the world might have to unite against the hostile forces from some other planet. And at a commencement exercise at West Point, General MacArthur made a similar statement to the effect that the next world war might actually be an interplanetary one.
So with these apparent hostilities, have people disappeared? I mean, we have people disappearing all the time off this planet, or we don't know where they are. Could they be taken?
Well, yes. I theorize in the book that they have been. Of course, you've had on David Filaides, who has written a series of books on missing 411. Now, most of the cases that he has investigated have taken place in national parks. But there are other areas, too, where people have disappeared mysteriously. Well, we have a case here going back to the 1930s. I'm sure you've heard the name thrown about Judge Prater, who walked out of his office. He was a lawyer here, and he walked out of his office, was headed to Broadway, had dinner, and was going to meet a lady friend to see a show on Broadway. And he mysteriously vanished in the midst of hundreds of people along the Times Square, and was never seen again. There's another case of a theatrical producer up in Toronto who disappeared. It was during a snowstorm. He had been at the theater. He had shaken hands with his friends and some of the actors that he knew, and he headed out into the night. He stopped at the local newsstand where he always picked up his evening paper, and he was very upset to learn that the paper hadn't come in because of the snowstorm. It hadn't arrived from New York. So he threw out a few curse words and headed out into the snow, and must have melted away because nobody ever saw or heard from him again.
Jeez.
And there are hundreds of cases like that. There's one in Springfield, Missouri, that we detail in the book. Three women, two of them, I think it was a mother and a daughter, and another young lady. They were celebrating the young lady's graduation, and they had stayed overnight at one of the houses, and the next day they never showed up for their appointment, stated appointment, and the people went to investigate to see, you know, why they hadn't shown up. And there was no sign of anything missing in the house. Their purses were there. There was no money taken. Their documents, you know, their ID and their telephones were there. Their cars were parked in the driveway. The front door was locked, but they were never seen since then.
It's amazing. Let's take a few calls here, Tim, and we'll chat more. Let's go to Chris in Huntington Beach, California. First-time caller for us. Hey, Chris, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you doing, sir? This is one of the twins that met you at
You guys were great.
How have you been? I just want to tell your listeners, they already know this, but your voice is like Sinatra. You dress with class, and you're actually extremely funny. If you weren't in radio, you could be an entertainer. So you're awesome. But my question to the guests would be, do you know why, you kind of touched on this too, George, do you know why aliens take some people and they never return, as opposed to some that take them and they do return? I don't understand how that works.
That's a good question, Tim. What do you think of that? Some go and some don't.
It's such a good question that I have no explanation for it. Just like we really don't have too much explanation for any of this phenomena. I mean, we could offer theories and ideas and concepts and talk about them on the air. But how many years has Coast to Coast been on the air? And you know, we're still debating and talking about all of these things and coming up with different ideas. And people seem to have different opinions. But we do know that some people have been returned. In fact, in the book, there is a case that where I spoke to one of the witnesses. It was three women. They were celebrating. One of the ladies had just turned 30 years old, and they were celebrating their birthday. They all lived in and around the small town of Liberty, Kentucky. Well, they were coming back from their the restaurant wherever they went for dinner, you know. They saw this object in front of them on the road. It was massive and metallic in size. Well, the car slowed down, George, and lifted into the air. I mean, we hear about people being abducted all the time, whether it's true or not. But here, the darn automobile went right along with them. And they were later hypnotized under the by Dr. Leo Sprinkle under the direction of Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who, of course, was had his own UFO group, Center for UFO Studies. They did. They were separated. They told pretty much the identical story. They did some sketches of the object that they had seen and the beings, and they all looked remarkably similar. But they were returned. Now, they did have some amount of missing time, but it wasn't like they were gone for an entire day or anything like that. And when they came back down to Earth, automobile and all, the vehicle was left on the ground or on the roadway about 10 miles away from where they had been taken. So here's the case. I mean, the three ladies in Springfield, Missouri, disappeared, and they never came back. We don't know for sure whether they were taken by UFOs or not. But similarly, in Liberty, Kentucky, three women were taken, and they were returned. So I guess it's kind of a the roll of the dice, the interplanetary dice, so to speak. In fact,
well, have things changed, though, where maybe now they're taken as opposed to before they wouldn't? You know, you look at the Travis Walton case, where he passes a lie detector test, and so did all of his loggermen. He got beamed aboard, he says, and then dropped down. I remember the Betty and Barney Hill case of the 60s, one of the classic stories. They were returned. Now that seems that they're keeping people.
Well, you know, again, it's hard to say which people are being kept. And, you know, of course, there are all sorts of nefarious people here on this planet that have nothing to do with ultra-terrestrials who kidnap people and so forth. There's a case, and I tried to get some comment from Betty Hill's niece, you know, who it's the...
Yes, she wrote a book with Stanton Friedman.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. I spoke to her just recently. And there's a case up in New England, I think along the same roadway where Betty and Barney had their abduction experience towards the White Mountains in New Hampshire, but I'm not sure. I haven't been able to pinpoint it in correlation to where Betty and Barney might have been picked up. But this lady was driving out in the snow. She had apparently a minor accident. In fact, somebody came along and offered her a lift. And she said, no, 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 the tow truck was going to come or something to that effect. Well, they found the car the next day. I mean, they put out a search party. And at first, it took them a while to locate the car. They finally found the automobile. It was locked. Her purse and everything was inside. No sign of a struggle or anything missing. And she's been gone for 14 years. Now, jeez. Nobody's saying it's a flying saucer picked her up, but every once in a while, some constable or a deputy sheriff will say, well, they're missing it. It's like aliens took them, you know, kind of in a snide, a snippering way. But maybe they don't really know what they're saying. It could well be that they have departed the planet night of their own free will.
And, of course, it was Kathleen Martin, who's the niece of Betty Hill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She wrote a book with Stanton called Captured, which was an incredible story. I remember, and I've cited this story several times, Tim, when I was 21 years old, a radio reporter in Detroit, I interviewed Dr. Simon, Benjamin Simon, who was their psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And he was in Boston, and I remember asking him specifically if he believed that story. And he said he put them both under hypnosis. They both corroborated what each other said under hypnosis, not knowing what the other was saying. And he said, I don't know if the story is true or not, but whatever happened to them, they believe it to be true. They're not lying. They believe this happened to them. And he said, that's an amazing story.
Absolutely. Well, you know, one of your other frequent guests, Joshua P. Warren.
Yep.
Well, did you know that his uncle mysteriously disappeared, or maybe it was his granduncle, North Carolina, southern boy, you know, and the uncle was sitting on the front porch in a rocker waiting for the Sunday meal to be prepared. They had seen him and talked to him briefly on the way into the house, but when the kinfolk came out to call him in and tell him the duckling was ready, he flew away like the goose, man. Nobody ever saw or heard from him whatsoever. And you know, they scoured the area and sent out a search party, and whammo, nothing. You know, now we've got a case that's described in the UFO Hostilities book that took place in Brazil. A lot of these reports take place in South America and in Brazil in particular.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Well, there is an incident where a young boy, I think he was 12 years old, not very well educated. He lived in a very rural area. He had no TV set. He didn't read science fiction. He didn't know anything about Star Wars. So this was long before that. One night, he had three brothers living in the house, and he lived with his dad. His mother had passed away. One night, there was a yellow glow that came in through the window, and there was like a mist that threw a shadow onto the wall, and there was some a voice of some sort saying that they had come for his father. And apparently his father had prayed long and hard, and the shadow in the mist disappeared. Well, the next day, the boy and the father went out to the field to gather up one of their horses. Two globes appeared and merged into one and sucked the father into the globe, and he was never seen again.
Wow. Stay with us, Tim. We're going to come back and wrap things up and take some final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Timothy Green Beckley with us as we talk about UFO hostilities and the evil alien agenda. There's more information for you, too, at coasttocoastam.com. Lex has posted some great stories there. It's kind of scary to think about. It really is. Anyways, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with Tim.
Hey, everybody. This is National Talk Show host Clyde Lewis of Ground Zero, and it's my honor to announce that George Norrie has been nominated to the National Radio Hall of Fame. But to be inducted, he needs your vote. And you can vote several times. By text, you can dial 96,000, like a phone number, that's 96000, then text the number 700. If you have numerous phones, you can vote as many times as you want on those phones. That's 96000, and then text 700. Also, you can do it by email as many times as you can with different computers. Just go to www.radiovote.com. Vote now until June 18th, and let's get George Norrie elected to the National Radio Hall of Fame. For full information, also, you can go to coasttocoastam.com. That's coasttocoastam.com. Vote for George Norrie.
Well, how about that? Thank you, Clyde. I really appreciate that. The final segment here with Timothy Green Beckley and your phone calls as we talk about the UFO hostilities and the evil alien agenda. And, Tim, where do people get this incredible book?
Oh, well, two places. We have our own website, which is theconspiracyjournal.com. And, of course, you go over to Amazon.com and just type in UFO hostilities and the evil alien agenda. And, you know, it's there in both paperback and Kindle formats. And go to your website, Coast to Coast, and you'll find all sorts of links to our articles and websites and books. And, you know, my little publishing company, which I've been running since I was 14, we've got almost 300 titles. I think, not that I've written them all, that award goes very unchallenged to my late friend, Brad Steiger. He's still, I think.
Oh, we miss him. Just passed away.
He was my dearest friend in the paranormal field. I met him in 1967, and we spent many of interesting evening and weekend together.
What do you think of this latest story that the government spent $20 million researching UFOs?
Well, you know what's interesting? If you read between the lines, or you read the lines carefully, they actually say that some of the money was spent to, I guess, interrogate and interview witnesses to see what physiological and psychological effect their encounters with the UFOs had on them. Now, they are well aware that there is a cloaking nature to these objects, and I suspect that they realize that some of these things may be hostile. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Now, this is not the first individual or a group of consequence to make a such a statement or come up with such a conclusion. There was a gentleman who passed away many years ago, Dr. James McDonald. Now, he was with the University of Arizona's Meteorological Department.
And no relation to the McDonnell Douglas family, I don't believe.
No, right? not that I'm aware of. But anyway, he took UFOs very seriously. He studied them from an academic point of view. He did have some cases where these objects had given off a radioactivity, like we described in some of these events earlier this evening. There were a lot of reports where engines had, car engines had stalled. Lots of reports of planes that had encountered these objects and their engines had stalled, or some malfunction had taken place in the cockpit. But he was one of the few scientists and UFOs researchers ever to appear before a congressional hearing. And during this congressional hearing, he dropped a bombshell. He revealed the fact that he thought that there was a good chance that the November 1965 massive blackout that took place over the entire East Coast, plunging, what, something like 40 or 50 million people into total darkness, may have been caused by a power-sucking UFO or UFOs that were seen up in the Syracuse, New York area. Now, I concur with this because I did a bit of research on this myself, and there was an individual who was the caretaker for a church up in the Syracuse, and the night before the blackout, he was up in the the turret or the bell tower or whatever, you know, the steeple, that's the word I'm looking for, of the church, and he saw and photographed a number of fireball type objects in the sky. A pilot coming into the airport there in Syracuse on the night of the blackout also saw mysterious objects in the sky. Look magazine printed a photograph of what appeared to be a UFO over Manhattan. But probably the most sensational aspect of this a case or this incident came from a Hollywood actor by the name of Stuart Whitman. Now, Stuart, I guess, was best known for a film called The Sound and the Fury that was made, what, in the 50s, I guess, you know. Anyway,
that was a good movie, too.
Good movie, yeah, yeah. And he made quite a few films at the time. I think he may still be alive, but, you know, I really haven't followed his career. But I did talk to him on the phone shortly after the blackout. He was staying in a hotel off of Central Park, and he had woken up in the, you know, after the blackout, and he saw that, you know, he pulled a curtain. He heard a sound, like a humming sound or something, coming from outside the window. So he pulled the blinds of the hotel room aside, and he saw that the entire city was blacked out except for an object that was parallel to the window of the suite where he was staying.
Wow.
And he heard a voice. I don't know whether it was telepathic or not, but the voice said that they were responsible for the blackout that was taking place, and they wanted to show that they had could have control over anything that took place on the planet, causing blackouts, preventing missiles from taking off, anything pretty much that they wanted to do, that they had the physical means or the mental means of doing this. Now, he spoke telepathically or however with them for a few minutes. They said that they were responsible for the blackout, that they had caused other blackouts, and they even predicted, I think, some places where other blackouts would occur in the future, and those events turned out to be true. Now, he told it. I mean, it did get some publicity at the time of the story. I managed to get him on the telephone. I was working for a couple of men's magazines in those days, like True Magazine and Saga Magazine. And I was always me and John Keel. We were always doing UFO articles there, pretty much. So I thought that was a sensational case. And I talked to the fellow on the telephone, and he did seem to be very sincere. And so there's a good possibility that this massive blackout in 1965 was caused by UFOs in our sky.
Amazing. By the way, Stuart is still alive. He's 90 years old.
Oh, God bless him. Well, let's get him on the air.
That's something. I think he still lives in the L.A. area, too. Let's go to the phones again. We'll go to Wayne in Tacoma, Washington. Wayne, go for it.
Good morning, Sir George.
Hey, Wayne.
Hey, I'm wondering, I didn't hear the all the program. I'm wondering if you covered the 1947 expedition of Admiral Byrd into Antarctica to the Nazi base, and they got rebuffed.
He talked about that, but give us quick highlights for him, if you would, Tim.
Oh, well, yes, it was part of this project where they actually sent up ice cutters and military planes, and Byrd was supposed to stay up there for, I think, close to a year, set up an expedition, and he returned to the continental United States after only being up there, I don't know, a couple of weeks or a month or something, and had very little to say about anything that had happened there. Now, there is a diary. In fact, we have a version available on Amazon that he talks about finding this polar entrance. The Nazis supposedly are said to have a UFO base there, and the entrance to the pole is guarded by giants who live inside the Earth. It's a fanciful story, but it's an urban legend that has continued all these years.
All right, let's go back to the calls again. Joe in Long Island. Hey, Joe, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Tim. Do you have anything from Europe that might have predated air travel, say in London in the 1870s, or even all the way back to the Roman Colosseum? And then the other thing is, wasn't Howard Hughes involved with aliens or something like that? And I don't know where I read that.
Well, that I don't know about, but you're certainly correct about the cases taking place in Europe. I was just looking for my notes here. But two well-known cases was in Hamburg. One, and both of them were around, 1540 or something like that. One of them took place over the city. It was an actual aerial battle. And there is a broadsheet, I guess that would be an equivalent of a newspaper today, whatever they print it. And it shows this aerial battle taking place with a variety of different kinds of mysterious objects overhead. There's another case in the harbor nearby where actual cannons were fired at something in the water, and there were several beings that were seen floating in the air. Now, that's one thing, George, about UFO entities. They can float and they can fly, which I don't even know if they need a craft, to be honest with you. And some people, point out the fact that some of these craft are actually able to change shape, just like we have some, shapeshifters, like at Skinwalker Ranch. We also have UFOs that are able to change shape from cigar shapes to ball. They shrink in size and do all these weird things. But this one particular case in the harbor where they were shot at with a cannon, I think some 300 or 400 rounds, they finally chased off the citizens by screaming. I mean, the screaming got louder and louder and louder until it was like deafening. And, they've even used that, I think, in combat today, haven't they, where they would set up loudspeakers, across the border to get the troops all riled
or
whatever.
Sure, absolutely. And propaganda works.
Yeah. Well, the aliens scream the military men firing the cannons at them.
Are most UFOs that, show people disappearing and stuff, do they appear to be hostile or are they reacting to hostility?
Well, now that's the million-dollar question. There seems to now back in the early 1950s, around 1952, the UFOs appeared over Washington D.C. There was an order that went up to shoot them down.
Not smart.
Not smart at all. I mean, look at this guy, the Scoutmaster, when he just took a swing at one of these craft with a machete. Well, you can imagine what a plane would do if it was shooting a missile or some sort of artillery at it. And there was a case, and this is little known, but it is in the book. There is a fellow, he's long since deceased. His name was Captain Alvin Moore. He was with the Navy. And he was also worked for the CIA for a while. But apparently one of these objects over Washington, D.C. on that fateful July day in 1952 was actually shot at, and some of the debris landed in his backyard.
Jeez.
Well, he took the debris and put it inside a safe that supposedly only he had the combination to. Well, wouldn't you know, when he went to take the debris out, some of the debris out, to show it to somebody in the military, it was gone. Now, who had the combination to the safe? He swears up and down that nobody did.
I had somebody come up to me at our Las Vegas event this weekend whose uncle had a piece of the Roswell wreckage, and it was metal that they could not hammer, bend, or do anything with. It was truly remarkable. Tim, stay in touch with us. Good luck on this book, and we thank the world of you, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you so much, George.
Tim Green Beckley, just a great UFO researcher and author. We've got a series of great shows for you all week long. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burles, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.